Who knows what that says? You will now.
Perhaps morning.
It's better to go to a house of mourning
than a house of feasting.
Yeah, than a house of feasting, something like that. Life includes house or time of mourning and a house or time of feasting. We are going to go to both. But at least sometimes it's better to go to one than the other. Why? As a reminder, do you remember what the rest of the... Reminder of what?
The inevitability of...
Because that is the end of every man. And the living takes it to heart. The short of it is, we all die. They take it to heart. What is being taken to heart, or what should be taken to heart? That we all die. And what's the therefore? What's the so what?
We live according to that, knowing that there's a point in time.
Are you ready now to die? A sober reminder this last week. I'm reminded a few years ago, I was a friend of this man's brother. He was 24 years old, living his life, doing what he was doing. Called his mother and said, "Mom, I have a chest pain. I need to go to the hospital." And 6 hours later, he was dead. We have been reminded of the same thing this week. I'm impressed with, I know some of you aren't on Facebook, so this young man named Adam died, he drowned on Sunday. We had his father and his mother here September, the last one of the last weekends in September, for a gospel meeting, so their son died. I never met this young man. I know many of you did, probably all of you did, but me. My brother's wife's brother's wife's brother is who we're talking about. But on Facebook, Mrs. Bertina Smelso writes that she was cleaning out or packing her... She was in her son's apartment going around looking at the simple things. And what she found there was his interest in sewing and his musical instrument and his Bible and some study notes. And she didn't find anything... No, she didn't say this. I'm saying this. She didn't write about having found any pornography that he had hidden away under his mattress. Because he could have. Nobody would have known about it until she comes along to clean house. Didn't find any marijuana in a little baggie put somewhere. And he went out for a jog every day. And instead of jogging, he was smoking marijuana. We could do that. But apparently he was ready to go. And how are you ready to go? By not doing some things and by the grace of God, doing other things also. So the question is, are you ready to go right now? Are you ready now to go? Whether or not you go now, that's not what we're asking. Are you ready now to go? Am I ready now to go? So, in our study in 1 Samuel, chapter 13, that is where he sacrifices when he should not have. He was supposed to wait the 7 days, and he waited, and then he sacrificed, and boom. As soon as he sacrificed, here comes Samuel. And Samuel says in verse 14 of chapter 13, "Your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out after for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as a ruler over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." Then in chapter 15, God tells Saul, "Go kill Agag and the Amalekites and utterly destroy them," and he doesn't. And he again is going to make a sacrifice. And Samuel comes and says in verse 28, "The Lord has taken the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you. So in these two passages, we have the Lord twice saying, I'm taking the kingdom away from you and your family. It's going to be stripped from you. All right. So if it's going to be stripped from him, then we need a replacement. In chapter 16, we're introduced to the replacement. I'll just read one verse for now. Verse 13, Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him, this is David, in the midst of his brothers. Okay, understand what's happening. We now have a two-part story in 1 Samuel. I mentioned this last week. If you've read the book ever before, you know. The kingdom is taken away from Saul, 13, 14, and 15, 28. David is anointed in 16, 13. That's what we've read so far. Now comes the two-pronged story, and it begins in verse 13. Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward. Verse 14, now the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul. So we have two prongs here of what's happening, and now our history is going to include two different stories to the end of this book. Remember this, I have these in nice big fat outlines. This will be important for a little while when we come back to it. I'll ask a question. I hope that you'll understand that's what I'm referring to. I might do something like that. Okay, so in chapter 16, the Spirit departs from Saul. Now we're just going to hit the highlights, and I don't mean these are good things, just the highlights. Chapter 17, who comes in chapter 17? You remember? The Philistines? Goliath, right? Goliath. And what's Saul doing? Shaking in his boots. So, by the way, not much has changed for Saul, because every time somebody comes, Saul is shaking. We'll get more of this. So he's afraid of the enemy. At the same time, in this chapter, David kills Goliath. Already we see a stark contrast between the two. Well, at the end of it, of chapter 17 and the beginning of 18, after the end of that account, Saul is admiring David. At the same time, Jonathan is loving David also, takes off his armor and says, "Give it, here you go, take it." And that should include Saul up there also. At the same time, it says that Saul continues to send him out, and he continues to be successful. And he continues to be successful. The women are singing that he's killed his thousands, ten thousands, right? Whenever you have women singing about you, other men tend to, especially men of power, tend to not take that very well. So he becomes suspicious of David. Remember, he's suspicious of him from that day onward. Next thing we know, he's throwing his spear at David, trying to pin him to the wall while David is playing his music. Well, he doesn't stop there. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, in this time where he's trying to kill David, it says that David's going out and being more successful. At the same time, he's afraid of David, and he secretly plans against David with his daughters. He says, look, I'm going to have you marry my daughter, and that way the Philistines will get you. And, well, that plan goes out with the one daughter, and then Micah says, oh, I want to marry him. And he says, great, this is fantastic, and he plans that way. At the same time, he starts including others explicitly in his schemes. He's already including others, although they don't know it, in his schemes with his daughters. But then he starts telling his others, you go tell David that I want him to be my son-in-law. So he starts to including others. Then, verse 28 of chapter 18. In chapter 18, verse 28, Saul knew when Michal, his daughter, loved him, Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David. Now, if you're a reasonable man, what are you going to do? Or what are you going to stop doing?
Try to kill him.
Right. I got a genius idea. Stop trying to kill him and start trying to help him, right? Say, here's the kingdom. I don't know how the transition would have taken place, but God was in control. More success. So he goes out, he's trying to kill him, and David the whole time is just getting stronger and stronger and stronger. Then Saul, in chapter 19, verse 1, starts telling others, including his son, to go and kill David. Jonathan says, Dad, you're overreacting. And so Saul repents. But David, who's like a train that you just can't stop, gets more successful. And so Saul relapses and throws a spear at him again, his javelin, whatever it was. And then he chases him down here, and he chases him over there, and he chases him to a place called Ramah, where he at first sends his messengers. I send out my messengers. You read this in preparation for tonight. I'm sending out my messengers. Go get David. And what do the messengers do? Do you remember when they encounter the prophets? They start prophesying. What's the necessary implication? Yeah, God is, you're going against God. Stop what you're doing. Well, Saul doesn't get the message. And what does he do? He goes down. And he himself prophesies. What's the implication? Stop doing what you're doing. Does he stop? Of course not. David is protected by Jonathan in chapter 20. And so how does Saul handle that? Saul throws his spear and tries to kill his own son. Well, more and more people, or excuse me, David is helped by Ahimelech, who is the priest at Nob, and that family there. And so what does Saul do? How does he handle that? By the way, Ahimelech just didn't do this on his own. Remember, it says several times that he prayed to God. He prayed to God. So the implication is God's trying to help David, so stop if you're going against him. Saul turns paranoid. Right after Ahimelech helps David, Saul begins pointing to all of his brethren, his Benjamites. He's saying, you're all against me. And do you remember who says, oh no, I'm not against you? The guy who helps Saul, remember his name is Doeg or Doeg or Doug or whatever his name is. Do you remember where he was from? Edom. He's not even... So Saul is saying to all these Benjamites, his brothers, you're all against me. Were they all against him? No, he's paranoid. He's lost it by now. Not only that, the only one who will actually stand up and say, oh, no, I'm not against you, is an Edomite. And of course, that Edomite is the one that slaughters all the priests, a whole town of priests, and their children, and their wives. And not surprisingly, really the next thing we read is that people start flocking to David, 400 it says here. Now we could go on like this, but we've made the point. There's a definite difference between what is happening with David and what is happening with Saul. Basically, it continues downhill for Saul until he commits suicide. Saul, chapter 31, we didn't read there. They're fighting the Philistines. They're losing. Saul is wounded. Verse 4, chapter 31, verse 4. Saul said to his armor bearer, draw your sword and pierce me through with it. Otherwise these uncircumcised will come and pierce me through and make sport of me. But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. So Saul took his own sword and fell on it. So, here's the question. What we observe here is David just kind of skyrocketing, or at least on an uphill climb, while Saul is plummeting. And he has his worst moments and his worst moments. How did both of this kind of start? Oh, both. Yes, it started with Saul's disobedience. But this track record of these two different people basically began with a record of David receiving the Spirit. We're introduced to David with he's being anointed, and wham, he receives the Spirit. At the same time, what's happening with Saul? He loses the Spirit. Okay? My point is, that is basic. It's definitely the beginning for David, and it is when Saul's downhill decline takes a turn for the worse, right? David, you cannot stop him. But Saul gets worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. There's 16 of them up there. You can't stop Saul either. Exactly. But we're not surprised, because this and only this is what will happen when God is for or against you. That's what this is illustrating. God was for David. God wanted Saul to repent, but Saul's not repenting, and so God's against him. On and on and on. The tide. Who here knows what an ocean tide is? Anybody? Anybody not know? Yeah, so the ocean tide. Who's ever stopped the tide from coming in? Nobody, right? So the tide's coming. Who's going to be the one to go against the tide? I'm going to go out there and I'm going to stop the whole thing. Anybody? The fool would, right? The fool will say, no, you're either with the tide or against it. This isn't a metaphor this time. Now it's a metaphor. Right? How about the rotation of the earth? Has anybody ever stopped the rotation of the earth? I got a great idea. Let's have everybody line up. Which way does the earth spin? I forget. The opposite way. Everybody lines up the opposite way and starts walking. Is that going to stop the earth? Is that not ridiculous? But it's the same thing. When you're fighting against God, you're fighting against the one who made the tide and who makes the earth spin. You're either with him or you're against him. Having said all that, Romans chapter 5. Verse 1, therefore, having been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom also we have obtained our instruction by faith into this introduction by faith into this grace in which we stand and we exult in the hope of the glory of God. And not only this, but we also exult in our tribulations, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance proven character, and proven character hope. And hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out within our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. Do you see that? Look what you can do because you have the Holy Spirit. The last thing there is hope, and before that is proven character. What is that talking about, proven character? What's character? Character is our characteristics, the kind of person we are, whether we hate or love, to cut it to the chase, right? Whether we hate or love, whether we're obedient to God in all things or not. Proven character. In other words, this is getting at, you can be the kind of person God wants you to be. And what all is mixed into that? The Holy Spirit, who He has given to you. The point being, the opportunities are limitless for proven character. You can be who you ought to be if you have enough faith. All you have to do is get on the right side and let God, and be a partner with God. Let Him mold you, and you accept His molding, and you mold yourself. With His Spirit, you can turn into the person you ought to be. So, if you find a character flaw, what's the problem? What's the root cause?
Self-will.
Self-will. Exactly. That's right. Putting me first and God, whatever, second or last. If you're first, then God is last. Comments or questions on this? Here's a question for you. You can stay here in Romans because I'm going to turn here. Do you remember what happens to Saul in chapter 9? That's where we're first introduced to Saul. What's he doing? He's chasing down his donkeys. Walking around, says, well, I can't find it. I'm going to go up there to Samuel and see if he knows where my donkeys are. If you had asked Saul in chapter 9, Saul, do you think you have it in you to slaughter a whole town of priests and family? I'm guessing this is speculation, but what do you think Saul would have answered? Never. Never. Now, he would have gone up and down, he would have said never. Okay? So, chapter 10, he's informed you're going to be the king. Let's ask him again. Saul, you're king. Do you think you have it in you to ever... No. What is he going to say? I'm guessing he's going to say no, right? And chapter 13, where he offers when he shouldn't. If you asked him in that chapter, Saul, do you think you have it in you to ever slaughter an entire village of priests, what do you think he'd say? I'm guessing he's going to be consistent and still say no. I know I'm guessing here. Chapter 15, when he doesn't slaughter Agag and he's going to make her sacrifice. If you asked him in that chapter, Saul, do you think you have it in you ever to slaughter? What would he say? Again, he's going to say no up until he's already done it. And then he's going to say, I still wouldn't do it. Well, if you reject God in one area, no matter how trivial that area might be, there is nothing to moor us to him, his laws, in any area. Or you could say, really, this should be to any degree. Okay, so he didn't wait 7 days. You know, let's throw out that's trivial. It's not. But thinking in a worldly perspective, we'll say that's a trivial sin. But if he's willing to do that, then there's nothing to stop him from doing what he ended up doing, slaughtering an entire town of priests. The short of it is, be careful when you're observing yourself and you're just dismissing some law that God has given to us. We don't live under the law of Moses. We live under the law of Christ. Galatians chapter 6. We are under the law of Christ. We have a law. So anytime we take one and just say, it doesn't mean you're going to go murder somebody. But have you ever heard somebody say, oh, that's an argument from the slippery slope? You're arguing from a slippery slope. It'll never happen. Yes, it will. It's not like he just turned into a murderer one day. This is what happened. Romans 1:21. You remember what chapter 1 of Romans is about? You know what it has in it? Depravity, including sodomy. Right? Romans chapter 1. Look in verse 29. These people are filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice, gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, unmerciful, unloving. Although they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they do not. They not only do the same, but they give hearty approval to those who practice them. And we didn't even read in here, but it's in just a verse or two before that. They're sodomy, homosexual behavior there. Do you remember how it started? What was their first sin in this passage? Do you remember? 21. Even though they knew God, they did not honor him or give thanks. That's how it started. Don't raise your hands. But if you are, this is just one example. And maybe there's another one that fits. I hope to God there isn't. But this is just one example. If you are not, every time you have a meal, if there's been long periods of time where you're not saying, thank you, God, for this meal, as mundane as that might seem, as simple as that might seem, what does it say? Verse 21, they knew God, they did not honor him or give thanks. And that's how this whole slippery slope started. Next thing you know, not exactly, but you give it a little time, and they turn into these rebellious people. So one way to maintain not turning into that person is pray to God and thank him for the things you have. And that is giving him honor. God, I recognize that everything I have is from you. Number one, thank you for it. Maintain that, and that will help you. That's not the only thing, right? Here's another question for you. Just going to be careful how I word this. When we are following the life of Saul, we can see marked changes. You know, he's not good. And then sometimes you see, wham, he takes a dip, and he stays down there. And then he's not good, and then bam, he takes another one, and he stays down there. And you can see him incrementally, you can see him getting worse. With David, you cannot see him incrementally getting better. He does slay the giant, but he was already that kind of man. That was just an example of who he already was. You don't see him getting incrementally better. Right? Yeah. Okay. So you don't see him getting incrementally better. Does that mean he never got incrementally better? Right. People get, and in fact, he's still getting incrementally better, right? You just don't see these huge changes anymore, because guess when that happened to David? For David, it happened when he was... Excuse me? When he was... Yes, exactly. It happened... It might have been when he killed the bear. That might have been one of those huge things. He understood the Lord was working in that somehow or protecting him. It might have been before he killed the bear and the lion. I don't know when it was. We all go through these, but some of us go through it when we're young. And then what's the rest of life about? Hanging on. Exactly. Maintaining is what I would say. Maintaining. That's what we do. Are we looking... Because if you look for the... Wow, look at that magnificent feat I had in faith the other day. And if that's what you're always looking for, guess what? You're going to be discouraged. Exactly. You just go out, you prepare yourself. Yes, you will have, and you'll be able to look at it and say, hey, you know what? I finally got over that sin. I just got over it Friday. I know it. Or I realized it on Friday. Friday I did something that I haven't done or haven't. I didn't do something I have been doing. There's a huge step there, but that doesn't always happen. Usually we're just hanging on and maintaining. In chapter 22, in 1 Samuel chapter 22, chapter 22, he slaughters all the priests. In chapter 23, verse 19, the Ziphites came up to Saul at Gibeah, saying, is not David hiding with us in the strongholds at Horesh on the hill of Hakilah, which is on the south side of Jeshimon? Now then, O king, come down according to all the desire of your soul to do so, and our part shall be to surrender him into your hands. And Saul said to him, may you be blessed of Jehovah, for you have taken compassion on me. What does he say? In one chapter, he's killing God's people. It doesn't get any closer to God than the priest, if I can make that statement. And he was killing them. In the very next chapter, what is he saying? May you be blessed of the Lord. What was his problem? What was one of his problems?
He's defining. He's defining God's enemies based on who his enemies are. Lincoln, I think, prayed one time that maybe it was the second inaugural. He says something along the lines of, "We shouldn't pray that God is on our side. We should pray that we're on His side."
Yeah.
And that's kind of the difference here. This is he's making the wrong choices here about defining his enemies.
Right.
God's enemies, based on who?
On him.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Did you say that Saul, I suppose you could say it, but wasn't Saul a sociopath?
Yes.
Suffering from some kind of mental illness.
Okay. I don't want to go too far with that, because he is still accountable. He is still responsible for his behavior. Yes, we are always. So, but somebody says, you know, he's got a mental problem, so he's not accountable. That's the brackets in there. That's the therefore. We don't ever want to throw that in there. There are people who have mental problems and they're not accountable. Yes, there are. But we, especially in our society, are so quick to jump there that everybody, nobody's accountable. Nobody's accountable anymore. Whatever problem he had, he was accountable for it. For his behavior. You said he had a definition problem. Definition problem, essentially, is what he said. Let me suggest this. He was deceived. That's essentially what you're saying. You know, and he thought, he had this interpretation, and he thought he was right. How? I mean, isn't this so? This is so blatantly, blatantly contradictory. He kills God's people and then says to them, and then says to other people, "May you be blessed of the Lord." How does that work? He's redefined something, and he thinks he's right. He's deceived. So, how do we help Saul? Do we give him? Do we go bring him to the psychiatrist and say, "What's Saul's problem, and how do we fix it? Give me the. I need a trip to kidney drugs." Is that the answer? No, because Saul is accountable.
It's imparting knowledge the way that Nathan imparted knowledge to David.
Yeah.
You're the man. And David had the character to recognize that he was right.
Yeah.
So Saul was told also. and yet, I think that the power that he enjoyed as king, you know, power corrupts, ultimate power.
Yeah.
Absolutely corrupts, or with absolute power corrupts absolutely, is the same.
Yeah.
And because look at Jonathan. He's second in line.
Right.
Right? He's going to be the next king if everything works out. But what's his attitude on the thing? Hey, David, you're going to be the next king. And he didn't have a problem in the world with it.
No.
But what was his motivation? Love.
Yeah. You said instruction. Like Nathan. I'm reminded of Sunday's lesson on the fools. God would say to this man, administer the rod. Now, I didn't say this in Sunday's lesson, but who gets to administer the rod? God does. You let God administer the rod. And one of the forms of the rod was not smacking Saul with some kind of disease, but smacking him with the ability to prophesy. Bam! You know, remember this. In God's discipline, it's not always displeasurable. The implication may be, but the act itself may be. Next thing you know, this guy's prophesying. What's the point? Stop messing with my person. Right? And as you said, Nathan, our plan is to patiently teach. Look at 2 Timothy chapter 2. Second Timothy chapter 2, verse 24. The Lord's bondservant. Now, this is written to Timothy, who was a young preacher, evangelist, and so it definitely applies for them. But who here is not a bondservant of the Lord? I am. We all are. So it applies to everybody. The Lord's bondservant must not be quarrelsome. Would that have worked with Saul? That would get your head chopped off. Remember Jonathan, right? Was not even quarrelsome, but when he approached with reason, later on he would be thrown a spear at him. Be kind, able to teach, patient when wronged, with gentleness, correcting those who are in opposition. Listen, if perhaps God may grant them repentance leading to the knowledge of the truth, and they may come to their senses and escape from the snare of the devil, having been held captive by him to do his will. That is, you know, that is all of us have a little bit of that. We don't know it. Or we at least have the potential for it. Right? All of us have probably, I can't say this absolutely for sure, because somebody in here might be 100% right on everything. Not me. But, so we're in the snare a little bit. We're in the snare a little bit. Everybody's in the snare a little bit. Some people are like Saul. I mean, they're just in the thick of it. So what do you do with them? You let God administer the rod. And meanwhile, you're sitting there, you're pinging them with knowledge, like Nathan. You're the man. You might want to try a different approach here and there, but our job is to teach patiently. You know, Brandy, she's a great girl. She's asking, what do I do with this one certain person out there who's a fruitcake, from what I've understood? This person is just totally a fruitcake, totally driven on emotions. But even the emotional person reasons, because you ask them, why do you do this? And they will give you a reason. They will give you a reason. So they're using reason. So she's like, what do I do? My first response was, good luck. That was a little joke, right? But just be patient. Teach. Ping them when you can. And pray to God for help. The same thing with Saul's problem. Comments or questions here? Yeah.
It sad to watch this because Saul could have lived his whole life in obscurity and died a very faithful and godly person.
Just stepped out of the way.
Yeah.
Repented. Boy, I messed up. Yeah. But he wasn't going to let it go. All right, so back here in chapter 16. Really, we're going to get to the end of 18. Don't worry. I know you prepared for 19, but... Okay. So, chapter 16. Verse 1. Saul said, the Lord said to Samuel, how long will you grieve over Saul since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Real quick point. When God makes a decision, accept it and move on as quickly as you can. Fill your horn with oil and go, and I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have selected a king for myself from among his sons. Samuel said, how can I go? When Saul hears of it, he will kill me. And the Lord said, take a heifer with you and say, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. You shall invite Jesse to sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do, and you shall anoint for me the one whom I designate to you. So Samuel went, did what the Lord said, came to Bethlehem. The elders of the city came trembling to meet him and said, do you come in peace? And he said, in peace, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice. He also consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to sacrifice. When they entered, he looked at Eliab and thought, surely the Lord's anointed is before me. Do you remember what he said about Saul? Here is your king. Isn't it? There's nobody like him in all of Israel. It doesn't sound like Samuel's learned very much, did he? Can you imagine God thinking, Samuel, didn't you get the lesson for the last time? How many times does it take us to understand something? Aren't we all still working on something? Right? 2 years later, wham, it hits me out of, this is what they've been trying to tell me this whole time. How many times does it take us to learn something? So, be patient with others, right? At the same time, be patient with yourself. I've known people who get discouraged because they just can't get it or think they're dumb because they're not getting something that's simple or something that other people get or whatever the case might be. And then finally, all of us have to be patient with God, right? Ultimately, without his patience, where would we be? Something else from this. Samuel said, how can I go? When Saul hears of it, he will kill me. The Lord said to him, take a heifer with you and say, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Liar, liar. Pants on fire? Either God commanded him to lie, or this is not a lie. I'm going with the second. This is not a lie.
It wasn't a lie.
A subterfuge, maybe. So what do we learn from this? Not telling the whole truth can be permissible. Can be permissible. Did he tell the whole truth? No. Was God okay with that? Yes. Not telling the whole truth can be permissible. So what Abraham did is all right. Abraham, did he tell the whole truth? No. Remember, what was the deal with Abraham? What am I talking about with Abraham?
She's my sister.
She's my sister. Was she? Yes, she was his sister. But she was also his wife. Now, here's the way I would explain this. In Abraham's case, are you married to her? Was the question they were asking. That's what they wanted to know. Whether they asked that or not, that is specifically what they wanted to know. In Samuel's case, are you coming here to anoint a king, David? Was not something they were specifically asking about. We don't get that from the text, okay? So there's a big difference. Now, let me go on. In Abraham's situation, not telling the whole truth was intended to create a false impression that what was a fact was indeed not a fact. He answered that way to create that false impression. Samuel's case, he didn't want to create a false impression. He wanted to avoid the thing altogether. I don't want to talk about that over there, so I come up with this. And as long as I'm talking about this, as long as you're focusing on this and not asking me about that, I'll be okay. That seems to be what's going on. Does that make any sense to anybody? If not, and even if it does, maybe the following recommendation would be good. If you can't figure out the difference between what Abraham did and what Samuel did, and I'm not saying I know it for 100%, but if you can't figure out the difference, then stay away from it. Tell the truth, tell the whole truth, and tell nothing but the truth, and trust God. I'm not recommending that people start playing games, because you can start to play games with this. Because it looks like they were playing a game with Saul. Be careful. And if you don't know how, in any given situation, don't play a game. Just tell the truth. And trust God that He'll work it out for you.
When Jesus said, what do you say, be as gentle as doves and cunning as vipers? It may have been something altogether.
Right.
But it certainly seems like
that. Yes, it does. And when we can't figure out how to be cunning, then be gentle. Be gentle and tell the truth.
We were just reading Acts 16, 17, 18, wherever it is, where Paul the Areopagus, and he starts his spiel with, I'm going to tell you about the unknown God. Well, there was a lot more to it than that, a lot less to it than that, as far as, you know, oh, I can see you religious people.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
You know?
Right.
But if he was going to be effective, you have to start somewhere. And where you're starting is with the understanding of where your audience is at.
Mm-hmm.
And working from there. That's all that Samuel's done at this point. I mean,
right.
Yeah, they can handle the heavy stuff maybe a little bit later. You know, it's really what it boils down to. Putting some of that stuff off so it can be effective right then.
Right. Putting it off. Not saying, I'm not here. Are you coming to peace? I'm not here to anoint David. He didn't say that, right? Chapter 16, the rest of this chapter. The Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul. Saul starts getting these things. And, by the way, the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord terrorized him. Okay, if you watch a great example of how to understand this kind of language is turn to Job and what happened with Job. I'm not suggesting you turn there right now. The first two chapters of Job, who did it?
Satan.
There's no doubt in your mind who did it. In the last chapter of Job, in chapter 42, the author says that God did these things. Now, did God do it? No. This kind of language understands God is completely in control. This author understands that and he knows it 100%. And he accommodates his language for it. There's a short side note here. Does our language reflect what we know about God? It ought to, right? Okay, so he starts getting headaches. I don't know what the deal is, whatever it is. He says, I need a skillful musician. And so they send him David. Awkward. Not so awkward for, maybe awkward for David, maybe. But actually not awkward for Saul yet, right? Not yet. Because Saul doesn't know what's going to happen. Maybe awkward for David, if David has the faith that he always has everywhere else. He's just trusting God. So it's not awkward for him. But here are these two people thrown together. We know the rest of the story. What's going to happen? These two people, one of them primarily, is going to be butting heads, butting heads, butting heads. But you know what? Couldn't that happen with anybody? Somebody walks in this door, and we begin a relationship with them. Stick out our hand, start shaking theirs, and saying, good to see you, great. Well, everything's wonderful, but you know what we don't know? If everything will continue to be wonderful, what is the one thing it depends on? It only depends on one thing. Close.
Love.
Who? What?
Love.
Yes, love. It depends on if they're both committed to the standard. That's all it depends on. If you're both committed to the same standard, and the standard is the gospel, then you know what? That relationship is going to be perfect. That doesn't mean you'll always understand each other and agree with each other, but you know what? Things will work itself out, won't it? Why did what happened to Saul and David happen to Saul and David? Because one of them said, I reject God's law. That's why that happened. One of them didn't. One of them said, I'm going to do what God says no matter what. And the other one said, I'm not. I'm going to reject him. Have you ever heard the expression, fellowship will take care of itself? Here's the question. Okay, so there's a lot of differences out there among churches and people. And so, how do we handle these differences? How do we handle the people in any given case? What do we do? You know, this person, and there's that, and here I am, and what should I or should I not? Well, here's two people, and here's the standard. You commit yourself to that standard, and the rest will take care of itself. If they're committed to the standard, fellowship will take care of itself. If they're not committed to the standard, fellowship or disfellowship or whatever will take care of itself. It always depends on whether or not people are committed to the standard here. Comments here? All right. We'll just do chapter 17. Chapter 17, the Philistines gather for the armies. Okay, chapter 16 is an introduction to David, to Samuel. Chapter 17 is an introduction of David to Saul and the nation, kind of. Chapter 18 is an introduction to David on the national scene. Everybody knows who. In the beginning of chapter 18, who's David? The end of chapter 18, everybody knows who David is, right? Okay, so chapter 17, here comes this guy Goliath. And we'll skip the details, but he's a big dude. Here he comes. Everybody's shaking in their boots. David said to Saul, verse 34, your servant was tending his father's sheep when a lion or bear took a lamb from the flock. I went out after him, attacked him, rescued it from his mouth. When he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard, struck him and killed him. Your servant has both killed the lion and the bear. The uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God. And David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine. So Saul said, go to it. Tries to give him his fighting equipment. David says, no thanks, that's not going to work for me. Then, verse 41, the Philistine came and approached David with a shield bearer in front of him. The Philistine looked and saw David, disdained him, and he was a budding youth and ruddy with a handsome appearance. Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come with me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Remember that. And the Philistine said to David, come to me and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field. And David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts of God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day the Lord will deliver you up into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you, and I will give the dead bodies of the armies of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. You know the story? David gets him with a sling, runs up, chops off his head. As he's going up there, verse 55, Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, and he said to him, who is this? Actually, he asks, who is his father? Technically different. Who is this guy? What's going on here? David will finally say, I'm David, the son of Jesse. But God is saying, Saul, that's somebody with faith. This guy is somebody you need to look at and say, you could have been like him, but you've blown it. You've messed it all up. Real quick, Does anybody know what Li Tosti means when he has that up there? And with the exclamation point, when I have the exclamation point, this is something specific to me. Okay, well, Jehovah, yes. Okay, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and everybody knew who God was. But then they rejected him, right? And ever since then, they rejected him, and directly connected, they reject his moral law. And ever since then, what has he been proving to people? I am the only God there is. I'm the only God there is. He does it in Exodus. He does it again. He does it right here. Did you notice that? He comes. The Philistine comes with his gods. This isn't a story about David and Goliath. This is a story about Jehovah against Dagon. That's what this is a story about. And who wins? That's why God has to do this, so everybody knows I'm the only God there. He runs and he cuts off his head. And when everybody sees that, the Philistines see that, what do they know? They know that Jehovah's the real God. What else can explain this monster beating up this little child? But the fact that it's one of them has a real God, the other one doesn't. At the same time, verse 47 said that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear. That's pointing back at Israel. They were all shaking in their boots. We can't beat them up. We can't beat them up. Every Israelite out there saying, we can't beat them up. And David says, what were you thinking? You're children of God. You should know this. And so in his one act, he's, by implication, condemning all of them for what they had not done. God did not leave the Gentiles in the darkness. When they left this, guess what they knew? There's one God, and it's Jehovah. So then why didn't they continue to know about Jehovah? In verse 9, Goliath had taunted, you send out one person. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, we will become your servants. That was the deal. We will become your servants. When the one came out and fought him, and they lost, what did the Philistines do? They ran. That, after having proof positive, there's a God over there, the God of the world. If they wanted God, what would they have done? Come and take us. Capture me. Take me. Take me. They didn't want God. It's not that God left them in the darkness. It's that anytime he exposed himself to them, they said, most of the time, no thank you. Except for folks like Nineveh. Comments or questions? We'll call it there for a night. Thank you for your work.